What I would like to do and what we decided that we would do tonight is for me just to give an account of what happened last weekend, especially from my perspective first, as a lay perspective, someone that was there at last week's meeting. For those of you that don't know, Ed and Graham, following the ordination of our nuns a couple of weeks ago, was summoned to his original monastery in Bangkok in order to give an account of himself, so-called give an account of himself as to why he went against what was apparently a rule that he shouldn't ordain nuns. So I'd like first of all just to just talk about the extremes of the weekend first of all, because travelling with Ajahn Brahm is really it's quite different. You know, on an aeroplane with him, and we were met at Singapore by some of the beautiful people that are in the group up there in the Singapore Fellowship, who took me in for a bed, and all very very. Beautiful people, all keen to know about Ajahn Brahm. And what sort of struck me there first of all, and what I think it's important to say in the context of this whole talk tonight too, because there's some fairly strong things I've got to tell you tonight about what did happen on the weekend. But when you go through there, you can see just what effect Ajahn Brahm has had on so many people throughout the world, whether it's just people you meet in the airport, which I've got one or two things I'd like to just say about that, but also the friends and the Buddhist Fellowship people in Singapore whose hearts are really just so filled up with love, and just how much effect Ajahn Brahm really does have on these people. Now, what actually did happen last weekend is that Ajahn Brahm was effectively disenfranchised from his monastery. This is the Wat Pa Phoa monastery in Thailand. What that basically means for us here is really not too much. So I'd like to first of all just set everyone's mind at ease in that nothing too different is going to ever happen here. The monastery here and the Buddhist society itself has its own constitution. We have it well set up. It's a well balanced, finely tuned constitution, in fact. It's been developed over many years. So that's the first thing to say. Everything, as far as this centre goes, and also just looking at for the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore too, the same there. Everything will go along fairly much as normal. But now coming up to the meeting, we arrived on Sunday. The meeting that Ajahn Brahm was to attend was at 6 o'clock. But I'd like to just tell you about a little encounter that I had with a senior monk, a very senior monk. I'm not going to name names, and really right through this whole talk too, we're going to be really very keen not to try and blame or try to inflame the situation any further than what it is, because it's very important for this to have a chance to settle down, and I'm sure Ajahn Brahm's going to say something more about that when he talks to you. But I did want to just tell you about what this monk said to me, because he was kind of exhorting me to really take you all into my confidence, because he said that he and a few other senior monks from Wat Pa Phong were quite worried about what was happening here at the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, in as much as that they were worried that we might have been coming a little bit like a cult. Now, it sort of rocked me in my shoes when I really heard that, and I just wanted to let that, contemplate that and let it sink in. I mean, I think that the people that think that are really so far from the truth, it's just not even funny. I mean, every teaching that I've ever heard here is really about letting go, rather than trying to hang on to Ajahn Brahm as a cult leader. He always tends to want to get rid of supporters rather than the whole of the teaching is about letting go. So I was just contemplating that, and I know that sometimes, I have talked about this to Ajahn Brahm too, sometimes Ajahn Brahm teaches in a way, well actually this teaching, it's been such a wonderful teaching for me over the years, ever since, really, because I've been watching and living with Ajahn Brahm ever since he's been here. And I've always been a fairly jaundiced kind of a fellow anyway, so I'm always looking to see if someone's congruent or not. I said to you 2 weeks ago when I was talking to you that I thought that Ajahn Brahm was one of the most congruent men that I know, and I still believe that. What I mean by that is that what he says, what comes out of his mouth, and the way that he conducts himself is very much in sync. There isn't a mismatch there at all. I have never really ever saw a mismatch. But there is one thing that he does do that I think maybe might cause some people to look a bit askance at him sometimes, and that is that Ajahn Brahm is sometimes a very good skiter. He actually knows he knows about his own goodness, and if you've actually seen him practice that, from my point of view, I mean, I've always found this very hard to do, because Western people in general, I think, have a hard job being very positive about themselves. Most of us are very negative. You know, we can always find fault in ourselves, even though that we're very, as a general rule, we see ourselves as fairly clever people and probably fairly generous people and so on. But as a general rule, I think we are really quite negative about ourselves. Ajahn Brahm is never like that. When he sees something good inside himself, he has that ability to be able to celebrate it, to bring it up, and to have fun with it. I'll tell you a little story that happened in Bangkok Airport. Ajahn Brahm, sometimes going along with him, he reduces everything to a farce, really. We're going along, and he says, come in here, Dennis. So we go into this bookshop. And I see him there, he's sort of excited and bubbly, starting to sort of jump on his skin and so on. Takes me up to this bookshelf. Look, have a look here, look there. What do you see? You know, sure enough, there's two books with Ajahn Brahm's face on it looking out, two of Ajahn Brahm's books looking out from the bookshelves, along with the Dalai Lama, because his books are bestsellers in Asia. And the next minute, you know, this excited monk, and that is, he's standing there, you know, with me sort of looking at his books, and then the bookstore owner notices him. Ajahn Brahm, is that really you? Is that you? So over they come, and then all the storekeepers, they're all there, so they're all lining up for photos with him. Now, as an example of what I'm trying to say here, if that was maybe someone else or a Western person, I could really even say myself too, I probably would want someone to be able to notice those books. I'd be very excited and proud that I'd actually probably produced a work like that. But I probably wouldn't be as straightforward as what Ajahn Brahm is. I'd probably find a way to surreptitiously maybe guide you down that path and sort of maybe lock the shelf and see those books there. I'd maybe look askance or something like that. You know, and in that there is a kind of a conceit. There's a little bit of a deceit there when you do that. And I think to a large extent we all do that. I hope you realise what I'm talking about with this. Ajahn Brahm never ever does. That's because he's congruent. And when I first realised that, it was many, many years ago, I realised that that's the way he does work like this. I actually started to practice it myself, and it's been an absolute boon in my practice, because when you do treat yourself that way, there's the opportunity for contentment to come into your mind is very, very, it comes into your mind very, very easily. And that's why I think that Ajahn Brahm's mind too is such a contented place for him to live in. So whether or not that has something to do with this maybe perception that some of these monks have seen, or that some people have seen, that he maybe skites a bit, or you know, maybe he's blowing his own bags or something like that with regard to these kinds of things. I think if you come and live with him and watch him, and I'm sure that the monks at the monastery would sort of verify, and those that you really do know Ajahn Brahm will know that what I'm saying is true. Ajahn Brahm is a very, very congruent monk. So that takes us on to the meeting. And what I might say about that meeting is really, I won't say too much about it, except that it was a very, very fierce meeting. And I really think that really the outcome of it was worked out before we went in there. I don't really believe that Ajahn Brahm really had a chance, much of a chance anyway, to... But as I'll tell you, there's one little incident that happened in there that I think was really, really quite interesting with that. But it was very fierce and uncompromising, and I think just a core group of monks there were really very keen to clip his wings to maybe stop him from sailing perhaps as high as what he might want to. There were questions of secrecy that I won't go into too much here, but I'll let Ajahn Brahm maybe answer those questions of, or allegations that we were very secret about this. There was some truth to some of that, but it's been well and truly overstated. And I might just say too, for the record, that our minutes are now not available generally on the net, and I wish I had been able to say this at the time, the last weekend, but to be honest, I just didn't know. I only found out this bit of information since I came home and spoke with Peter Smith, our secretary. And that is that about a year or so ago, maybe a bit more than a year ago, the committee at the time, I wasn't part of the committee then, but the committee at the time, under the privacy laws here, had checked about the minutes and putting the minutes just generally on the net. And from that time on, they haven't just been readily available. Anybody that wants a copy of the minutes of the committee meeting minutes can certainly get them, but we don't just have them there for anyone to download because of the Privacy Act. So I just want to make that clear to those that were interested in that part of it. And also, there were a lot of questions about why didn't we wait for the WAN meeting, and once again, with those, I'll let Ajahn Brahm perhaps talk about that more, because it's more for him to talk about that. In this meeting too, one thing that I do want to bring you all in on is because the whole thing was conducted in Thai, so I had kind of a limited understanding of it, although I knew exactly what was happening all the time because I could tell by the way the things were coming and going. But one senior monk from outside of Wat Pa Phong wrote a letter in saying that he had heard in Ajahn Brahm's talk 2 weeks ago, and hopefully most of you will remember that talk, in answer to a question where a gentleman somewhere in the middle here asked Ajahn Brahm, what would Ajahn Chah do in a situation like that? And this monk actually wrote in his letter that Ajahn Brahm said that Ajahn Chah would agree with the proposition. Now, I know that that wasn't what was said. And this is actually what happens, I think, when you have a certain idea, you know, you're going down you've got a certain momentum up going down, the perception is very easy to get mixed up. Because what I remember Ajahn Brahm saying in answer to that question was that Ajahn Chah would first of all ask, do you have any doubts? And then he would say, if you have no doubts, well then you go ahead and do it. But that whole question was answered, I think, in the context of putting the responsibility of these kinds of questions back onto yourself, not the other way around, in getting somebody else to answer your questions for you. So there was, in the meeting, a lot of situations like that I think were very unfair. In fact, I thought the whole meeting was very ignoble. It wasn't, from my point of view, especially going to, because I wanted to go to Wat Pa Phong for so long, and this was my first meeting there, and it was not a very noble thing at all to see my monk being kind of pilloried the way that he was being.
It's not always like that.
I'm sure that it's not. And I know that all these monks are very good monks too. I'm not, and they're very good friends. And these monks that I'm talking about are good friends of mine too, and I certainly don't want to ever anything come in between with that friendship. But just in this meeting, there was also a time when Ajahn Brahm, it was obvious that things were going bad. Ajahn Brahm, with the consent of his fellow monks back in Bodhinyana, had made an agreement that if he needed to, he would make an apology to the monks at Ajahn Wat Pa Phong for what he did, and he would also make a promise that he would not ordain any more nuns. Now, when he put this out, there was a palpable silence, there was an opening that opened up in the silence of that room, where that could have worked. You could sort of feel that, oh, this is going to come to a resolution. But unfortunately, there were three monks there who, after probably, it felt a long time, but probably after some seconds, said to Ajahn Brahm, no, they said, that is not good enough. You will need to completely recant. We want you to say that ordination that you participated in was illegal. And Ajahn Brahm, of course, said, I cannot do that. And so they then proceeded to disenfranchise him. I might say, too, that I didn't really notice much democracy in the meeting, too. I know that there was lots of people that probably would have liked to have supported Ajahn Brahm, but in the meetings that they have there in these kinds of situations, there really isn't much chance to do that. You would have been a very brave monk to stand up there and say anything in support of Ajahn Brahm. The whole thing was just taken on all those in favour, and there was a few grunts around the room, and then it was done. So I doubt that it was really even legal what happened, but be that as it may, that's the way that it did happen, and we've got to live with it. So that's the way that it goes. After the meeting, I did have some discussions with some of the younger monks there, and you can see that there's a great dilemma in a lot of the monks' minds there. The older monks there are just dead set against it. I might say that this proposal, had we waited for the WAM meeting or done anything to put that ordination off, I can tell you very, very confidently, my opinion is that if we did do that, the nuns would not be ordained for a long, long time. So I think that the way that it happened and the advice that the committee had to take the ordination forward at the time we did was a correct one. It is unfortunate that the circumstances have turned out like this. We're probably lucky that most of us aren't going to sort of notice too much about the whole thing. It's really just Ajahn Brahm that's wearing the ignominy of this with his friends. And that's really probably the saddest thing about it. But I did notice with some of the monks that were there that they were saying that they could understand and that they really did support what we were doing. And they had this firmly in one side of their mind. But they would also tell me, but then we live here in the northwest of Thailand. It's a very conservative place. They were telling me about the Mae Chais that they have there, that are 8-precept nuns, and some of them are very, very skillful nuns too, apparently some even enlightened nuns. But nonetheless, that practice, the 8-precept Mae Chai practice there, is a very unfortunate one for the women, I would think, and I think any of you looking on from here would probably think that too. But then that's not for us to say in another culture. Other cultures have got to really look after their own way of doing things. But anyway, these Western monks that were seeing that were telling me about their tension in their mind between, you know, wanting to support this and wanting to and seeing the other way and having to leave that in their mind there. But what I do say to those monks, though, is that sometime in the future you're going to have to resolve that tension. that tension will have to be resolved. And I think for us, we're on the side of history because I don't think that women are going to become more suppressed in the world. I think it's really probably going to be the other way around. So I guess just in bringing my comments to a conclusion, I probably just see this whole thing as like a family argument in a way. It's a bit like a family spat. And the parents have like thrown us children out. Go out and find your own way in the world. And it's a bit like that. But in having said that, all I can say is that I am very, very grateful to Wat Bah Pong for the way that it produced such a wonderful teacher in Ajahn Chah and the follow-on teachers Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Yanadamo, Ajahn Sumedho, all those wonderful teachers that have come out of that tradition. And I really thank all of those monks too, all of those Western monks, even the ones that don't support us here now, that your contribution to Buddhism has just been wonderful, really. And the contribution that you've made here in Western Australia has been wonderful over the years. All the retreats that Ajahn Sumedho has done here, all the teachings and attention and kindness that's been given here by Ajahn Yanadamo. We don't want to see you or feel like that you're cut off. Please do come and visit us. We would love you to come and visit us. Ajahn Sumedho, please come and do a retreat with us. We would love you to come. So with those few words, all I can really do is just hope for, in some time in the future, a reconciliation to happen. And when that does happen, perhaps the brothers that live over in Wat Bah Pong can come here to Western Australia and meet their new sisters. So I'll leave my remarks at that. And thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. So again, all these things are only just little temporary hiccups on the path towards enlightenment, not to really be taken too seriously. But these things do happen in life, and just even in monk's life. I thought when I became a monk, I would not have to have anything to do with such politics in the Sangha. That's a group of monks. I thought that when I became a monk, I could find a nice little cave and meditate all day. I thought when I became a monk, I wouldn't have to sit out there and answer all your questions. I thought I could live nice and peacefully, but the world isn't like that, so you just have to accept the world and make peace with it. But today I want to talk about how you deal with these situations. And first of all, to understand that this is normal, that not every monk, not every nun is fully enlightened with no defilements. We're all still learning. So first of all, you accept that this is par for the course. It happens. And it just blows over afterwards. And in the end of the day, I'm very happy because we've got four wonderful new fully ordained nuns. And there's always the old Australian saying, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. And for all of you girls who've had children, giving birth to something is actually quite painful sometimes. So you know this is par for the course. But it's really strange that the closer you are to your friends, especially, now these are some of the monks I've grown up with. And you know, to be quite honest with you, we are friends, we remain friends, and these little things which happen will never break that friendship. And many of the monks I've been talking with since, and even some of the old-time monks I've known for years, they say, oh, don't worry about this. You know, it's just nothing. It's okay, you have to sort of regard you no longer as a branch monastery of Wat Bah Pong, but that doesn't change anything. You're still a monk, you're still my friend, and we will come and visit each other, and we'll talk with each other, we'll be friends together, because we're monks. This is just some of the little politics. But it reminds me of a story. That once this man was walking home probably from hearing a talk from somewhere, but he wasn't a Buddhist, so he wouldn't have come here. And he was walking and he was crossing a bridge, and there he saw this man standing on the edge of the bridge and ready to jump off, ready to commit suicide. And he went up to that man and said, "Don't do it, don't do it." He said, "Don't stop me." He said, "No, leave me alone." He said, "Look, I'm a Christian, I have to try and stop you." "You're a Christian," said the man about to commit suicide. "That's a coincidence, so am I. I'm a Christian too." And the guy was trying to stop him and said, "And I'm a Baptist." "Wow, I'm a Baptist too. That's a coincidence." And the guy who was about to jump off said, "A Baptist, Southern Baptist or a Northern Baptist?" And the guy trying to stop him said, "I'm a Southern Baptist." Oh, no, the guy trying to jump off said, "I'm a Southern Baptist." "That's amazing," said the guy trying to stop him. "I'm a Southern Baptist too." "Southern Baptist under the 1929 reform or outside the 1929 reform?" And the guy about to jump off the bridge said, "I'm a Baptist following the 1929 reform." And the guy trying to stop said, "I'm not. Jump off, you evil guy." And that was a story I heard a long time ago. It shows that sometimes the closer we are, sometimes the more we argue. And I think that's sometimes the case because we're so close together, some of the monks we have in Wat Pa Phong and the monks here, that sometimes there's these little differences of opinion. But the most important thing is always to keep these things in perspective. And the other story I remember was a lovely story from Zen Buddhism. Now this is what you should do, or what I do. You know, if people want to sort of excommunicate me or throw me in jail or kill me or whatever, one of the stories which I always recall from Zen Buddhism of this monk, I think it was Hakuin, one of my favourite stories, that he was a simple monk who lived on top of the mountain just meditating and being kind and caring to his local village. But one day in the village, there was a girl got pregnant by her boyfriend, and they weren't married. And as soon as the father saw his daughter was pregnant, he said, "Who did it? Who was responsible for you becoming pregnant?" And the girl, of course, she was in love with her boyfriend and realized if she told her father it was his boyfriend, he would probably get beaten up or maybe even killed. So she thought, I can't dob in my boyfriend. Who can I dob in? So she thought, the monk up the hill, he did it. So the father was just irate. That monk, we've been looking after him, we thought he was such a great monk and he's made my daughter pregnant, that's not on. So he got all the village together and they went right up to the mountain, you know, right there and then, and they said to this monk, "You bad monk, you terrible monk, you've made my daughter pregnant, you can't do that, you thought you was a good monk." And even though he's totally innocent, all he would say is, arsehole. And so he didn't actually react with any anger back or any justification. And so after a while, I mean, if people aren't reacting, you can only shout at them so long. So they all went back down to the village. But now, when she gave birth, they went up again. And they said, "Law of karma, you're responsible for this baby. It was a girl. You look after it." And they tried to dump this baby girl on a monk. And if they tried to do that on me, I wouldn't know the first thing about looking after kids. You know, some of you have seen, even today, somebody came to with their little baby and they gave it to me because it's in the Thai tradition, if you give like your little baby to the monk, it's like I'm like their godfather. So, and I took hold of the baby, hoping they'd take it away quickly enough before. I don't know how to hold a baby, and what if it poos and get my old robe? It's just, poof. So I gave it back, but this little Hakuin, he was actually given this girl, a baby girl, to look after. And instead of protesting, he said, "Don't give it to me, I'm not responsible, and I don't know how to look after a baby girl." You know what he said? Arsehole. And it's amazing that I've been taught as a monk, and I know it's true, it doesn't matter what happens, you can always make it work. You know, I learned how to lay bricks, I learned how to run a monastery, I give talks to disability services, and I say about that talk I gave about shipping. If you don't know that story, that at a transport conference run by Winalana McTiernan was the Minister for Planning, she invited me as a member of the public to this transport conference. And during the lunch break, which was after 12, I couldn't eat, so all the people were having lunch, and this journalist came up to me and said, "I'm a shipping reporter." I said, "Oh, yeah?" He said, "Can I do an interview with you?" Now, I don't know anything about shipping. I've been in a ship, but that was just, I think, just across from Southampton to the Isle of Wight, not very far. But, you know, I'm up for anything. So I sort of answered the question and gave my advice on shipping. Why not? Nothing to lose. And do you know, this was amazing about this story. This is true. I saw him about 6 months later, and he said, "Ajahn Brahm, you wouldn't believe the success of that article which I wrote. I called it Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm, and it was syndicated in all the major shipping magazines of the world." And he got all these emails back from all these professors and experts saying, "We don't know who this Ajahn Brahm is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about." And that was true. And so, you know, talking about shipping, when, please don't do this, but if you did give me a baby girl, you'd figure out somehow how to look after them. But anyway, so he accepted this, but don't get any ideas. He accepted it, and he looked after this baby girl for I don't know how long. But what happened next was that scallywag of a boyfriend. You know, you girls know what some of these boys are like. You know, after a while, once he did this, he ran off to the city and found another girl. And this poor girl, you know, she was pining for her child, as you would do. And she realized she'd done a terrible, terrible thing of accusing this monk for something he never did. So she confessed. She confessed to her father it wasn't the monk. It was this boy she'd fallen in love with. And because, you know, a young girl loved him so much, wanted to protect him, that's why she blamed the monk. And this scallywag boy had run away, so she never wanted to protect him anymore. She was so sorry. So once again, all the villagers, they went up. They went up to the mountain again, saying, "Oh, we're so sorry. We did a terrible thing. We shouldn't have done this." You know what the monk said? "Our soul." And he gave the baby back. Now this was a wonderful little lesson that sometimes you're treated unfairly. Sometimes that what they say you did, you never did. And sometimes you even say disenfranchised. And what do you say? "Our soul." Now what that really means is that you use your equanimity, realizing that these are things which happen in life. And if people are trying to make you upset, one of my favorite sayings, and this is what a saying which, when I remember that book which Dennis was talking about, the opening the door of your heart, this was the one saying which the former Premier, Jeff Gallop, he told me he loved this so much, and he sort of kept this in his head. And he said, when I said, "Never allow anyone to control your happiness." So what other people do, they can beat you, they can hit you, they can say all bad things about you, but I'm never going to allow that to make me unhappy. And because that's something I learned a long time ago, you can actually practice it. And so after that meeting, I slept well. We had a wonderful time coming back together with Dennis. And so, happy ever since. So whatever happens to me, no way am I going to allow that to take away my happiness. And if I can do that, can't you? So if your husband excommunicates you, if your wife says, "Bye-bye, darling, I'm leaving," whatever happens, yeah, it may be a problem and deal with it, but please don't take it like it's the end of the world. And don't take it that seriously that you're going to suffer about it and get unhappy about it. Because sometimes I've seen already, sometimes on the internet about this, people are overreacting. It's only a tiny thing. It is business as usual. we'll still get all the monks coming over here, and our monks will go over to Thailand. It will all settle itself out. Because it has to, because in the end, you know, we don't carry around these things. So it's all going to finish up with everyone being happy and well. But in the meantime, keep it in perspective. And the story, which is how to keep things in perspective, and I, of course, remember this, what Dennis says, maybe I go skiting. By the way, skiting means is actually praising yourself or building yourself up. But I admit, I'm a skiter, a real champion skiter. And I encourage you to do the same. Praise yourself, because instead of, you know, pointing out all your faults and making yourself negative, you have got good qualities in you. And what I said, I think, last week, whatever you focus on, whatever you remember about yourself, that's what grows. So if you recognize the good qualities in yourself, those good qualities will grow. If you recognize the good qualities in other people, those good qualities in other people will grow. So we just forget about little faults which people have from time to time. But the main story is, how big is my hand? How big is my hand? It is now so big I can't see any of you. Now, it's not my hand's fault. It's because I've got wrong perspective. I'm holding it too close to myself. When I put my hand where it really belongs, at the end of my arm, it's the same size as it always was. But now it's the end of my arm. I can see my hand. I can see all of you as well. Now, this is what happens when people have difficulties and problems in their life. A problem with a spat with your monastery where you grew up, or a problem with maybe a suicide in your family, a problem with your shares going down the gurgler in the stock market, I don't know whether it's gone up or gone down, a problem with getting a cancer, or whatever else your problem is. Remember that sometimes, because it's my body and my cancer, we put it so close in front of us, we can see nothing else. We obsess. And we don't have any perspective. We put it out here, we have perspective, it's the same problem. Yeah, this meeting happened, but look at all the wonderful times we've had together in the past with all these monks. Look at all the... One of the things I did with Dennis, I showed him around, sort of Wat Pa Pong, all the memories I have, all pleasant memories of that monastery. Including, for those of you who know Northeast Thailand, there are these black ants called Mot Lin. I first learned about Mot Lin when, during a Waisak ceremony, we had to circumambulate around the main hall, walk three times around, like we do over here. And I was new to Thailand, I was new to all these rituals, and I couldn't figure out why Ajahn Chah was dancing. And then the monks follow him. The senior monks were dancing. And then the middle monks were dancing. And then after a while I was dancing, because these Mot Lin, when they bit, they hurt like hell. They're much worse than the bull ants we have over here in Australia. And I remember showing Dennis the good old Mot Lin. And oh, I mean, snakes, scorpions and centipedes, it was those Mot Lin what most of the monks were concerned about more than anything else, because there's more of them, and when they got on you, whoa, they hurt. So just these wonderful old memories where Ajahn Chah would actually sit and receive guests, and all those stories, like if you read in the book, just where the general came up to him and asked for holy water. And Ajahn Chah never had any holy water. So he said, come up here, come up here. And this was a general, I think he was major general. And you know how powerful the army is in Thailand. You know, they're always having coups every now and again. And so the general came up. And Ajahn Chah leant over. And he spat all this saliva on the general's head. And he took his hand and rubbed it in. And my goodness, even me, I thought, he's gone too far this time. It's the general, he's got a whole army to support him. And this general, what did he do? He loved every minute. Oh, this is special. You can't get more holy than straight from the mouth of an enlightened monk. And all those stories. Actually, I never told Dennis to ever to our monastery over in Wat Nanachat, just about 6 kilometres away, because I've got my own holy water story there, and I can't help sort of adding this one, because in those days, these monasteries, I've got such happy memories of these monasteries, and nothing can destroy those happy memories. And, you know, the monks, you know, who I saw afterwards, say, don't worry about this, you know. There's no sort of decision like that can take away the love you have and the friendship you have between these people you've grown up with. You know, for, 35 years. These things can't stop that. But anyway, I've been meditating all night. We used to do this once a week. All night, not sleeping, meditating. And you got up early in the morning, the first light, to go to urinate. Now, when you urinate over there, there are toilets, but this is a jungle. So what you usually do, you squat down on your haunches and just, you know, find a nice place and urinate. Now, remember, you're not standing up, you're squatting down. Remember just, you know, the position of the body when you're squatting down, okay? Now, it was first light, so, you know, you couldn't really see all that clearly, just in the first, maybe a few minutes after dawn. And it was tired because you'd been meditating all night. I thought I was urinating on a stick. And then the stick started to move. It was a snake! And a venomous snake. And, as I tell people, the most sensitive part of a man's body was only about 2 inches. Remember, you're squatting down. About 2 inches from that snake's mouth. Now, that was a very dangerous thing to do. But that snake, did it bite me? Of course it didn't. It enjoyed every minute of being blessed by holy water from a monk. You can't get any holier than pee from a monk. That was the time I peed on a snake. So I got all these wonderful memories of this place, and I still dedicate some of these memories. So I keep all these things in perspective. So whatever happens in your life, also please remember, keep it in perspective, so that you don't allow one or two sort of differences of opinion, arguments, to actually to take all of your attention, and you forget all these other wonderful times and happy memories you've had in the past and you're sure you will have in the future. Because otherwise, it's when we focus on just a couple of mistakes. We think, this is terrible, they shouldn't have done this to Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm shouldn't have done this to them. We should have done it another way. Actually, one of the monks over in England, he called me, and we had a nice chat the other day, and he said, look, you know, you'll always be my friend. He said, I'll always be your friend as well. So, you know, because we've had such wonderful times together. And he asked me, in hindsight, would you have done it different? And that's always a question people ask you. And you know, I said, look, I don't do hindsight, because you don't know what would have happened if you'd done it another way. Because sometimes, whatever you do in life, sometimes you think, oh my goodness, I should have done it another way, or maybe I should have done that, maybe I shouldn't. You don't know what would have happened if you'd have done it another way, if you walked another path. So I know, as a practicing monk, just looking back in the past and trying to predict what might have happened if you'd have gone left rather than right is a complete waste of time. Instead, here we are. Instead of looking back, what should we have done? Well, look, here we are. Now, how can we make it better from here on? And that's always been my practice, always to move forward rather than looking back. Because looking back, you can't change what has happened. So what's the point of trying to predict what might have happened if this had happened or that had happened or something else has happened? You can't do that. So I said, don't do hindsight. You know, that's why my eyes are in the front of the head, never in the back, because I can't see behind me. And that's why my mind is always in the front rather than the back. So we don't look at sort of hindsight. And he said, oh, that's a very, very good idea. And I said, no, see you again soon. So these are all friendships we always have. And sometimes you mention this. Why sacrifice a friendship which has been built up for so many years over, you know, stupid disagreements, you know, which are maybe one or two things which happen? And when you look at it that way, it does not make any sense at all to actually to break up friendships just because of one or two days of, you know, arguments or disagreements. the old simile of the brick wall. I'm not going to go into it. You can read it in the book. It's number one story. It's a good book. I'm going to sky it again because I got a... Sky again is praising yourself. I just got a fax the other day. There's two more languages it's being translated into, Croatian and Italian. I don't know how many languages that's in now, about 20, I think, now. But the first one in that book, the first story is Two Bad Bricks and a Wall. In brief, first time I laid a brick wall, I made two mistakes. Bricks at an angle, crooked, they spoiled the whole wall, and I wanted to destroy it. I was embarrassed about it, ashamed about it. Every time I looked at that wall, all I'd ever see is two bad bricks. I dreamed about those two bad bricks. I was ashamed because they spoiled everything, until one day someone came along and said, "What a beautiful wall." And I just couldn't understand what they were talking about. "What do you mean a beautiful wall? See those two stupid bricks in the middle?" And they said, "Yeah, we can see those two crooked bricks. But we could also see the 998 good bricks as well." And that was the very, very first time in about 3 months that I could see something other than my mistakes. Every time I thought of that wall, looked at it, I'd only see my two errors. And that's why I wanted to destroy it. When I saw the whole wall, that fellow was right. It was a beautiful wall. But I could only see two mistakes. And I realized that that was an error in my perspective. That was delusion. And I realized I've been doing that for so much of my life. I see one or two faults in myself, and I hated myself. If you want to know the reason why people do commit suicide, it's because they see one or two faults in their life. They can see nothing else, and they want to destroy everything. Like I wanted to destroy that wall. If you can just broaden your perspective and see, yeah, there are the faults there, you're not in denial. But if you see to the left, the right, above and below, there are good bricks, beautiful bricks. When you get perspective, you're not just looking at the mistakes right in front of you. You see, yeah, they're there, but there's other things around them. You don't want to destroy anymore. The wall was beautiful, it's still there. Now you can see that sometimes a friendship, you can break up a friendship because you see one or two faults. Someone's really abused you, or they said wrong things to you, or they just demeaned you. That's one or two bad acts. Yeah, you're not denying that. But why allow those one or two bad acts to destroy the whole wall? Even when I was in Malaysia many years ago, giving a talk at the university north of Kuala Lumpur, after the talk, a woman put her hand up to ask a question. "What's your question, madam?" "This morning, I found out my husband lied to me. I can't trust him any longer. Should I get divorced?" That's what she wanted. Reasonable question. But before I answered it, I said, "Can I just get some more information? How long have you been married?" She said, "About 3 years." "And by the way, what are you doing at this university?" And she says she was a professor of mathematics. And I saw my opportunity to answer her question. I said, "Professor of mathematics. I used to do mathematics at Cambridge. Let's do some statistics together." So I said, "3 years you'll be married. Let's call that 1,000 days. For the sake of this argument, let's say that on average, over the time you've been married, you said 20 things, or your husband has said 20 things to your date, your husband has said 20 things to you, which could be right, which could be wrong, ever since you've been married." That's a fair assumption. 20 statements over the space of 3 years, averaged every day, which could be right, which could be wrong. So, he said 20,000 things to you since you've been married. And now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, it means the next time he opens his mouth, there's a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean he cannot be trusted? 20,000 to 1 is pretty good odds, isn't it? So why is it that one lie means we can't trust them? When we ignore 19,999 truthful statements. Do you get the point? That sometimes a lie a mistake, an argument. We focus on that so much we can't see anything else. We want to destroy the marriage, destroy the wall, destroy friendships. Or sometimes destroy ourselves. To me, that makes no sense whatsoever. Now back to that simile of the wall. And you've heard it many times before. Actually, sometimes I mention over here that often I like giving talks to elderly people. Because they can't remember the joke which I said the week before. But anyhow, talking at the Cancer Support Association in Cottesloe. I usually go there once a year. And after I gave that simile of the brick wall, this builder came up and he said, look, I want to let you into a secret. Just to make you feel good. Even professional bricklayers make mistakes like that. So, you know, you're an amateur, we know that, but professionals do the same. But he said, I'll let you into a secret. He said, in the building industry, when we make a mistake like that, we tell our clients it is a feature. And we charge them an extra $2,000 for it. So if you've got a feature in your home, I guarantee it started off as a mistake. And I love that because that just adds that extra bit to the whole story here about mistakes, disappointments which happen to you in life. That actually is a feature. The argument you have with your partner, if you know how to put that in perspective, is a feature of your relationship. You love her not because you always agree with her. You love him not because he always does what he's told. You love him because he's imperfect. It's the feature which makes the love have a bit more bite to it, make it more important. It's easier to love people who are perfect. But isn't it that next level of love up, that greater spiritual jump, to be able to love someone who's not perfect? Because if you can love your partner because he's imperfect, you may even go to the higher level of loving yourself, who's very imperfect. Because we are imperfect, I'm imperfect, you're imperfect, we're all imperfect. Just like my wall. No one can lay a perfect wall, but we can love that wall. And we can see those mistakes as features. So in this whole journey of taking Buddhism to the West, you know, taking this ancient tradition from Thailand, the forest tradition, this is just what happened at Wat Pa Phong, the excommunication of Ajahn Brahm, is a feature. And it makes our life even more interesting and lovable. Because that's what it does, it's a feature, it gives us something to practice our wisdom and compassion on. So I thank those monks of Wat Pa Phong for giving me a chance to really see if I have understood Buddhism, if I can practice, if I can still love people who abuse you. And be kind to sort of a system which, you know, sometimes can appear to be misogynist, sometimes hierarchical and sometimes controlling. Oh yeah, it can appear that way sometimes, but you look at those monks by themselves and they're all just really sweet, kind, cuddly monks. They're all like that. And so, you know, if everybody else, if we think, those bastards, those horrible, terrible, misogynist, fascists over there in Thailand, what do they know about the Western world? What right have they to tell us we can't have nuns? If you start thinking like that, then you're missing the point. And the point is that they're creations of their environment, of their education, of their limited understanding. Now, I'm a creation of my limited understanding, my sort of environment, as each one of you are. So we just accept our differences. And when there's arguments, okay, yeah, we argue. That's par for the course. If you've got a mouth, it's going to open. And sometimes what you say is nice, sometimes not so nice. So, and you got two ears, you know why you have two ears, not one for. One is to go in, the other one to go out. So you don't always have to keep, you know, the bad stuff. That one actually you can put your hand over there to keep the nice stuff, the bad stuff in one ear, out the other ear. That's important. If you didn't have two ears in marriage, you'll never be able to survive. So remembering that we can actually keep things in perspective and not get so upset about things in life and look upon these things as beautiful features. Places where we can realize, yes, we can love each other, we can respect each other in spite of differences of opinion. And there may be arguments in this world, but we are not like terrorists. We're not going to go up and blow up that monastery in Thailand, and they're not going to send terrorists to come and sort of, you know, kill all the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. We don't do that. And so what you will find is happening, that after a while, it's just one of the monks told me, business as usual, it's just, you know, some of the things which happen in the world. So you don't need to take it too seriously. You know, we're growing Buddhism in the West in our particular way. Thailand may be different, and so we don't judge Thailand. You know, Thailand shouldn't judge us. You know, we don't judge Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka doesn't judge us. Sometimes you don't know actually which is what country. Because when I went to Thailand, there were so many Westerners over there, and so many Thais over here, so many Westerners in Sri Lanka, so many Sri Lankans in the West. We're all getting mixed up anyway, so I don't know what's going to happen in the future. We're going to have a mixture of everything. But in the future, you know that being kind, being compassionate, being forgiving, now that's a teaching of Buddhism. So when we are kind, when we're forgiving, when we're compassionate, we can give people a bit of slack. When you know how to do that, when I know how to do that, then we can create a more peaceful world. We don't need to have everybody the same. We can respect differences and differences of opinions as well. So whatever's happened in Wat Bapong, it's just what they felt they had to do, but it doesn't mean very much in the big scheme of things. In the big scheme of things, it's just a wonderful test for me. When I was young in Thailand, you know what was the biggest test for me when I was a young monk? It was actually wasn't these mottling, these biting ants, it was those damn mosquitoes. Oh, they were just vicious. And with the ants, you could actually jump over them. But the mosquitoes, I didn't know how to get away from them. They were all over the place. And we were supposed to be compassionate monks. And one of the things we used to chant every day is, may all beings be happy and well. I couldn't do that. I made exception. May all beings except those damn mosquitoes be happy and well. That's how I would chant. And you can understand why, as a young man, they were driving me crazy. But you know what Ajahn Chah said when I complained to him? Can't you give us some mosquito nets, some, you know, cream or something? It's malaria, and I get... And actually, I wasn't really afraid of malaria. I was just afraid of the irritation of those hundreds of mosquitoes on your skin. And what he said was, Bhava Wangsa. That was my name, Bhava Wangsa. Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn is the title, Brahm is a shortened form. Bhava Wangsa, he said, From now on, you look at those mosquitoes as Ajahn Mosquito. Ajahn means teacher. He said, Ajahn Chah said, I'm not your teacher anymore, mosquitoes are your teacher. And that was such a wonderful piece of advice. Because instead of actually hating those mosquitoes, I realized those mosquitoes had to teach me something. And they were great teachers for me. And you had to learn, it's only the body, only a tiny little piece of blood. But the feeling was one thing, and my mental fear, I hate this, I don't want this. That's what I learned. The mental reaction was far, far greater than the actual physical irritation. That's what Ajahn Mosquito told me. And now this is Ajahn Excommunication, or whatever else is. It's just a small thing. But you may think about that and feel terrible about it or angry about it. Now that's the problem. So it's a teacher for all of us, including myself. Just a teacher, it's just the mental reaction to it. The argument, shame, this is unfair. Now that's the problem in life. So when you understand how to deal with difficulties, like cancer, Anyone who's got cancer, what should you call it from now on? Ajahn Cancer. That's your teacher, that's your master. That's something to teach you something. Or you're getting separated, Ajahn Divorce. You learn a lot if you understand it properly. Or death. Ajahn, that's one of the greatest teachers of all. Ajahn, death. You learn so much from it. So whatever it is, whatever happens in life, especially the unpleasant stuff, instead of thinking, oh, this is terrible, this shouldn't have happened, why did it happen to me, it's unfair, instead, embrace it, accept it, learn from it, keep it in perspective, and then you'll find no matter what happens in life, it's never a problem. And it's a wonderful thing that when you're tested, because I know when I was a young Buddhist in England, this was 35, 40 years ago, that sometimes that people come up and they give these talks straight from the books, all made a lot of sense, but you see them afterwards, they weren't congruent. What they said in front of everybody was not actually how they lived. In fact, they lived angry, stupid lives. And I thought at the time that that's what we call the armchair Buddhists. They can talk about things, they can talk about the highest teachings around the coffee table. They don't know very much at all. Real Buddhism, real spiritual path, is what you learn in the difficult situations of life. When you do get disappointments, when you do stand in the midst of a sangha and people are criticizing you, when you are in front of your partner and they're shouting at you, when you are in front of your children and they're crying because maybe they're pregnant, maybe they're only 16 or 17. These are the times when you know and learn what Buddhism truly is. It tests you. How compassionate can you really be? How peaceful can you be in the difficult situations of life? How much of this do you really understand? So much that it does change you. Now that's actually where you know that these teachings have actually worked. And unfortunately, many of you have come up and told me personally, there have been some examples of your life, some terrible tragedies, and these teachings have worked. There was a death of your child, and you managed to embrace it, learn from it, and grow from it, without too many tears. There was a difficulty in your business. And like other people may have thrown themselves off the R&I Tower or Bankwest Tower, but you don't do that. You're someone who has a greater sense of Dhamma. And I can't help finishing off now because I'm already going off on a bit long. About another story. Hopefully you don't remember this story because I think I told it last year. I'm just remembering about the Bankwest Tower because there was some months ago a person who decided to jump off and kill themselves because of some terrible tragedy in their life. Actually the tragedy was this. They were a painter, an artist, and because of a motorbike accident they had to have their right hand amputated. And that was their painting hand. And having their painting hand amputated, they could not do the thing they loved the most in the world. The thing which gave their life meaning. They couldn't paint. So as soon as he was out of hospital, he climbed up to a high story, got out on the ledge and was about to jump off. When he saw, walking down St. George's Terrace, a man with no arms at all, dancing down St. George's Terrace. And he thought, my God, I've only lost one hand. And there's a guy with no arms at all, and he's dancing for joy. What do I want to kill myself for? And so he changed his whole mind and decided to live. But he wanted to find out the secret of this man, no arms at all, and he was so happy, dancing for joy down St. George's Terrace. So he ran to the elevator, went down, and ran after this man. He caught him. And he said, "Sir, sir, sir, you saved my life. I've lost a hand, I was about to commit suicide, and you saved my life. I saw you. You've got no arms. You were dancing down the street for joy. How can you do this? Tell me." And the armless man said, "Sir, I wasn't dancing for joy. I was just trying to scratch my bum." And that's the end of today's talk. Thank you. Okay, anyone, any questions? Yes, go on.
Just a comment. I attended the nun ordination, and we have been supporting the nuns for the past 10 years.
Yeah.
And they are the most wonderful people I have ever come across. And so they deserve, they make this place a better place to live in. And so they deserve our higher ordination.
Yeah, he was just saying that he was privileged actually to go to the nuns ordination at Bodhinyana Monastery. For those who couldn't come, one of the main reasons why we restricted it, the nuns' ordination, because it had to be done in the hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, because that's like a sima hall, like legally, you had to do it in there. And you had to have two sanghas, the Bhikkhuni Sangha, which we imported from the United States, Melbourne, Indonesia, and the monk Sangha. There was not enough room there to invite everybody, so it was actually Ajahn Wayama. Now, she tried to invite as many as she possibly could. If you weren't invited, on behalf of Ajahn Wayama, I really apologize, but you can only have a few in the hall at the time. So that was why it was not full. Everyone could come. We had the celebration the next day, as you remember. And again, he was saying that he's been to the ordination, been supporting our nuns for such a long time. They're really good nuns. They deserve a higher ordination. And I think that higher ordination should be made available. We've made it available, and I'm sure that many women in the future will make use of that, and it's a great asset. And look, we're in Australia. I could not... Actually, look, when I told Angie Monksfield, she's the head of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. It's almost like a sister grouping. And she said, "Phew, thank goodness for that," because she was speaking at a conference a couple of days after our ordination, Women in Buddhism. And she said, for the last, I don't know how many years, she'd been so embarrassed. The one weakness was that we didn't have fairness towards the female gender. And he said, "Now we have, thank you, I can go up there and be a proud Buddhist, that we're not discriminating anymore." So she thanked me effusively. And I think that's true. Me too. I'm now proud to be a Theravada Buddhist because we've started to have equity. So that's my feeling anyway. So thank you for that question. Any other questions, comments? Yes. Usually on questions I'm supposed to repeat to the microphone. Am I allowed to repeat that, Dennis? So just the lady was not really a question, but just saying that she was travelling to Thailand. She went to the airport in Singapore. She saw my book there, the meditation book, and she was so happy to actually see me there. And she told the people at the bookshop, saying, "That's my monk, that's my monk." A lot of joy. Why not have joy and happiness? And it's my monk. Why not? There's nothing wrong with that. At least I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And when people tell me, said, if you praise yourself, I only can get a big head. Hopefully that, you know me, that I haven't got a big head, but what you do, if you praise yourself, you get a big heart. And that's actually what happens. People who don't praise themselves or criticize themselves, their heart shrinks and shrivels. So you can't love. But with praise, recognizing your good qualities, those grow and you get this enormous big heart. So hopefully that those of you who know me, if you look at the size of my head and my heart, which is a bigger? Yes. What does disenfranchised mean? All it means is the monks in Wat Bapong, whatever they decide, doesn't affect us here. So basically, it gives a sense of freedom to say, well, look, we don't agree with that bhikkhuni ordination. I think they're afraid of, the big monks in Thailand, in Bangkok, what they may say. But I think the big monks in Bangkok, they're pretty cool as well. They know that there's no problem there. They just, Thailand doesn't want to stir things up. They want to sort of keep things cool. So if people hadn't brought it up, they'd have been very happy. So being disenfranchised literally means that basically nothing. So, we can still be friends, we can still talk with each other, we can still visit each other, we can still associate with each other. It just means we're not formally sort of a branch monastery of Wat Bapong, which doesn't really mean that much, to be quite honest. Martin Luther, yeah. But one of the things is, the important thing is that we say what Martin Luther did. In the Catholic Church, there is an inherent hierarchy. But in Buddhism, even though people like to have a hierarchy, they try and impose it. We all know that the hierarchy just isn't imposed by the Buddha. I gave a talk some time ago about democracy. One of the most powerful sayings of the Buddha, before he passed away, when people said, after I pass away, who will be your successor? Someone asked him. Who will take over the leadership of Buddhism? And he said, no one will. After I pass away, your leader, your pope, if you like, will be the teachings and the rules of Vinaya. The Dharma and the Vinaya will be your teacher from now on. That's such a powerful statement. So it means that, whatever monks in any monastery say, no matter how senior, no matter how old, the teachings of the Buddha always take precedence. So that is our Pope, the teachings. Not any monk, not any nun, not any group of monks or nuns. And that was such a wonderful saying of the Buddha, who saw, the great wise Buddha saw the problems which would happen if you did have hierarchy. So really, excommunication is only just an idea which doesn't have any validity. Disenfranchising is just basically just a word because it doesn't have any meaning in the teachings of the Buddha. And of course it shouldn't have. Therefore it is just something which will just fade away. And you know that because this is not a cult. You've known me for a long time. I can't tell you what to do. Sometimes I wish I could. No, I don't. I love it like this way, that you are free. Free to come, free to go, free to criticize, free to argue. You know that. You've been here long enough. The democratic decision making thing that you spoke about last week, is that part of the Buddhist teaching? The democratic decision making is that part of the decision, Buddhist teachings? Of course it is. Look at the Kalama Sutta. Just get on Google Kalama. It's one of the most famous teachings there. Don't just believe because I say so, because it's tradition, because it's in the books, because it's even logical, or because other people follow it. There's a whole list of things they said. If it makes sense, then follow it. Not just because it's written in the books. Not because Ajahn Brahm says it, or Ajahn Chah says it, or even the Buddha said it, or because everyone else does it. You've got to make sense. And I must admit that when we decided to do that bhikkhuni ordination, even though I knew it was totally valid according to the rules of discipline of the Vinaya. It's not a crack which any monk, legal mind could actually find fault with. That wasn't so important. It was important, but the most important thing is, what did it feel like? And for me it felt so much the right thing to do. And that was actually what I followed more than anything else. And you know, that's why I think many of you, you may not know too much about the rules laid down by the Buddha, but you certainly know in your hearts it's the right thing to do. And that's so important to remember. So that's what we follow. Okay, make this the last question and then we go. Yeah. Yeah, I get your point. In Christianity, there are many different governing structures. But there is a unity in Buddhism because the Buddha actually laid down these rules from the very beginning, and everybody knows that. It doesn't matter actually what Buddhist sect you're in, whether it's Theravada, Mahayana, Tibetan, we all share the same monastic rules. That's something which even the Dalai Lama recognizes. He said, look, it doesn't matter whether you're a Tibetan monk or a Mahayana monk or a Theravada monk, so we share the same rules. Some people keep them, some people don't, but the rules are exactly the same. And part of those governing rules is actually every monastery is totally independent. So we actually make our own decisions. It is autonomy, it's devolved authority. And within that monastery, every monk has an equal vote. So I get outvoted as well, even though I've been a monk for such a long time, you just get a monk who's just some up-and-coming whippersnapper just ordained today, he has the same vote as I have, just one. And that's the way it should be. So that is actually the governance. So all these other structures, which sometimes you may see, are actually imposed by the culture. They're not inherent or indigenous to Buddhism. That's why that sometimes some monks say, well, you may have that hierarchy, but it's not sort of valid, because it's not what the Buddha said. And many people actually say that and use that argument. And because it is a valid argument, it means really a lot of people know, a lot of monks know, it doesn't matter what people say in Wat Pa Phong or in the big monasteries in Thailand, our bhikkhunis are properly ordained and they know that and they can't find any fault with it. They are bhikkhunis, whether people like it or not. So that's actually our rule. And that gives it a strength and independence, which I think is one of the reasons why it's lasted so long. So anyway, did that sort of answer the question? No, not really. Okay. Yeah. 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 Oh, yeah, no, yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, yes, right, yeah. 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 That's right, yes, sometimes they do. And that's very dangerous. That's why, if ever you think this is a cult, sort of please put more power in the committee, or even better, join the committee. And that way you can actually see how we really run. And that's very good. I know that you are from the Uniting Church. Uniting Church, I've seen some of the ways that they have had their decision making. And sometimes the current moderator of the Uniting Church was telling me that sometimes in a committee meeting, they've got these little cards, I think. It's like orange, which means they're warming to the idea, or they put up blue, which means that they're cooling to the idea. So even if you're not speaking, you can actually see just how the argument is going. And that was a brilliant sort of little strategy there. So and they formed a beautiful sort of way of making decisions. Is that correct? Yeah. Beautiful. Okay. Thank you for staying on a little bit extra tonight. There's no extra charge.